today, and she got Sarah right in this club at the early bird meeting. And I know that there's quite a few people here who are excited to see her and are looking forward to hearing her story. And this is the first time I've met her, and I'm already excited. So come on up, Lisa.
My name is Lisa. I'm not going to lie. It is so awesome to be here. Sobriety date is July 10th of 2006, and I am as grateful as I know how to be for that. I have been ridiculously nervous all morning. Like, my voice is shaking, my hands are shaking, and I walked in here and I see all of you guys, and it just takes me back. I'm ready to cry. 9.5 years ago, I sat back where Eduardo was sitting, and I was in a treatment center right down the road, an all-women's treatment center. I'm sure there's some of you women in here that are probably in that treatment center right now. And we used to come in the druggy buggy. And this place was a little different. There was a smoking room in the back that just was terrible. This whole place smelled like smoke. And that smoking room, which you still can't see anybody back there. So hi, everybody in the smoking room. And that room over there where I used to hide out when I didn't want to be seen. And, you know, it's just, it's awesome. It's just awesome to be here. I'm ridiculously grateful. I was listening to Promises right now. And I was thinking, it's pretty much sums up my sobriety. Those promises would not have come true without working the first 8 steps before that ninth step and those ninth step promises. Before I get into all that, I do want to say that I got sober here. I moved to Austin about a year and a half ago. And I have a home group. My home group is Allendale. We meet at noon Monday through Saturday. We meet at 7 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you are in Austin, please come and see us. It's a large group, probably between 100 and 120 people a day at the noon meeting. So you would think I'd be used to speaking in front of a ton of people. But being back home, it's a little extra special. And I look around this room and I see those of you who knew me when I was really, really broken. Really broken. And I came into that 7 a.m. meeting and I was facing 20 to life in prison. And so many of you guys told me that wasn't going to be my story. That I didn't have to go to prison if I just showed up and I did the work. And I didn't believe you guys. But apparently you guys had some experience, and you had seen people in my shoes, and I guess we don't always go to prison for the rest of our lives. And I'm grateful for that treatment center, and I'm grateful for the women who took meetings to that treatment center, for the women who were properly armed with some facts about themselves, for those women that did their 12 step and carried that message. I didn't want to be sober. I was 25 years old when I got sober. I thought I was way too young. I was way too cute. I was way too smart. I was way too everything. Couldn't think of New Year's without a drink. Couldn't think of my birthday without a drink. Couldn't think of going through sentencing without a drink. How do you guys do that? How do y'all do that sober? There are a few of you who have been there, and I'm eternally grateful for the message of hope that you guys carried to me. I look back and I see Eduardo, and I can remember having breakfast with Eduardo and Vivian. Vivian's been on my mind a lot the last few days. Yeah, let's all cry again. And Vivian and Eduardo were sitting, we were having tacos and donuts at the donut shop. And Eduardo was like, Vivian's like, you're not going to prison. 95% of your fears never end up happening. And you waste all this time and all that, you squander the hours. And he was like, just be here. Just be where your feet are. Just be present. Just do the work. You're not going to prison. God has a bigger deal for you. God's going to use you for other things. And Eduardo's sitting at the table, and he's like, yeah, she's going to prison. True story, ask him. Let him go. You know, I, before I speak, I really spend a lot of time getting quiet about what I want to talk about. And it has been a crazy 9.5 years. And I always say that when I get up here, I don't want to talk about the 20 to life. Like, that's just, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about everything else that's happened. But I know that you guys are here, and I know some of you have kind of heard pieces of the story, and I know you guys want to hear it. And so I'm going to talk about it. You know, I didn't take my first drink until I was 19 years old. And I didn't take my first drink until then because I can't diagnose anybody, but I'm pretty sure that my dad and my grandfather could have benefited from being in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I didn't take a drink because I knew what was going to happen. And sure enough, I took that drink and it lit me up from my toes to the back of my ears, and it was on. And that quickly progressed to outside issues. And I am going to try my best to respect the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I wholeheartedly believe that they are absolutely important so that this message of Alcoholics Anonymous does not get diluted for the newcomer. I am an alcoholic. Alcohol was my first love. Alcohol was my last love. And there were a lot of substances in between. And my alcoholism quickly led me to those outside issues. And I made a whole bunch of promises, and I set a whole bunch of bars, a whole bunch of, I'll never do this. And I just kind of like went through those hurdles. And, you know, it's not that bad. And if I surround myself with people who are worse off than me, then it's really not that bad. I'm not that bad. I'm young enough where this is just a party phase. I'm in college. Everybody drinks like this. Everybody is hungover on Wednesday morning and can't go to class. And those outside issues quickly took me to a really dark place. I had this really awesome job, and that awesome job took me to Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, I found out that you can drink and participate in outside issues a lot more, and it's accepted over there. And everybody, these are lies I tell myself, right? Everybody's doing it. It's not that bad. Well, eventually that really awesome job got in the way of my drinking. And so I decided that I didn't need the really awesome job anymore, and I would figure things out. And I'm 22, maybe, figuring out the world. So I decided that in order to keep living the way that I'm living, I probably need to participate in some illegal activities. And so I do. And I start making a lot of money. A lot more money than a paycheck was going to pay me. And it was wonderful. I was traveling. I was going out. I was doing everything that, you know, any 22, 23, 24-year-old would want to do. Well, eventually I end up homeless in Los Angeles. But I don't think I'm homeless because I still have a car. And so I'm sleeping in my car in West Hollywood. I'm sleeping in my car. I'm parking my car at people's places. I'm sleeping on couches. But I don't think I'm that bad. Like, I'm gonna get it together. This will eventually come to an end. I'll want to grow up. I can stop. I'm not an alcoholic. I can stop whenever I want. And the lies that I truly believed. I really believed that if I wanted to stop drinking, I could. And I couldn't. And finally, I decided that it would be cheaper to be homeless in San Antonio. So, figured I could get a few meals from some people I know. So I packed up my car and I drove to San Antonio and showed up at my mom's doorstep. My mom's sitting here today. It's always kind of tough when your mom's in the crowd. I was about 95 pounds when I showed up. Thought I looked really cute. Coming from Los Angeles, everybody's skinny in Los Angeles. And my mom doesn't normally drop the F-bomb, but she said, "What the F is wrong with you?" And I was like, "Nothing, why?" And the next thing out of her mouth was, "Are you running from the cops?" Well, I wasn't yet. And I thought, huh. And, you know, whatever, I didn't think it was that bad. And so, you know, I kept on doing what I'm doing. Eventually got my job back with that super bad app. Ooh, I usually do not cuss from the podium. Whoops. Not my sponsor. That super awesome company, I got my job back somehow miraculously. And then that job was gone again. And, you know, at that point, it just didn't matter. Nothing mattered. I could no longer feel. I could no longer, I mean, if I loved you, if I made a commitment to you, if anything of value did not matter to me anymore, because I could not stop drinking. I could not stop. I had tried and tried and tried, and I would swear to everybody and to myself that I was not going to behave this way. That I was not going to be my father. That's what I always said. I don't want to be my dad. And I kept doing it. And so things got worse like they do. And in March of 06, I had back-to-back overdoses. The first one I thought wasn't that bad. I was only unconscious for 3 hours. So it wasn't that bad. The second one, I was unconscious for 3 days. So I thought maybe I might have a problem with alcohol and these outside issues. But when I woke up and I felt fine, I didn't think it was that bad. And so I kept doing what we do. Well, in June of 06, I got a knock on my door. And it was the FBI. And they had a federal warrant for my arrest. Oh, and I say knock on my door, knock on my mom's door. I was living at home. So let's just get clear on how manageable my life was. I was participating in these illegal activities from my mom's house. So I get this knock on the door, and that was my first introduction to the federal prison system. And I'm sitting there, and they're going over everything with me. And it says I'm facing 20 to life. I'm like, things might be bad now. 25 years old, I'm facing 20 to life. The soonest I'll get out of prison is 45 years old. Yeah, this is bad. But not enough. It's not enough. Because consequences are never enough for me. And so I get out of prison, and they tell me that I'm getting a drug test Monday, Wednesday, Friday. They tell me the dates, right? This is no surprise. We're going to drug test you Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And I cannot stop doing what I'm doing. I cannot stop. I don't understand the disease of alcoholism. I don't understand that this is a three-part disease. I don't understand that I have this mental obsession that tells me over and over and over that things will be different. I don't understand that I have a spiritual malady. I don't understand that I have a physical allergy, that once I put any substance into my body, I am no longer predictable to you or myself. I don't know that. And so I keep doing what I'm doing because I don't have a solution. And so eventually, July, this is only 4 or 5 weeks later, things have gotten progressively worse. And in July, I go downtown to the federal building again to pee in a cup again. And that day, there's something, right? The something at the time that I didn't know, but today I'm real clear that something was God. That something, that when I sat in the car in the parking lot, I said, all right, I can't do this anymore. You exist, help. And I cried and I screamed and I beat the heck out of my steering wheel and I just broke in my car. And I went upstairs to pee in a cup yet again. And when I got upstairs, there were two federal marshals waiting for me. I remember very, very clearly, I had my cell phone in my back pocket, I had my hair in a ponytail, and I took my rubber band out of my hair, and I put it down on the desk, and I took my cell phone out of my back pocket, and I put it down on the desk, and I put my hands behind my back, and I felt those cuffs go around my wrists. And I knew I was going to be okay. I didn't know what okay looked like, but the fight was over. I had no fight left. I was done. And I pretty much accepted that I would be in prison for the rest of my life. But that prison was much better than the prison I had been in leading up to that point. And I was okay with that. Because I knew I didn't have to lie anymore. I knew I didn't have to manipulate you guys. I knew I didn't have to find a way to get more. That was it. I wake up every morning, it's like, how am I going to do this again? And it's exhausting. And so I figured, all right, lock me up, right? That's the only way I'm going to stop.
And I was given a shot. I was given an opportunity. My attorney said, we hit a home run. We got you a bed at this treatment center. It's an all-women's treatment center. And I'm like, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not going. And there was a woman in prison with me. And she was like, you have to go. You have to go. She's like, it works. I was there. And I'm like, if you were there and it works, why are you sitting in prison? And thank God for that woman, and thank God for her message of Alcoholics Anonymous, because even though she had relapsed and she was sitting in a prison cell, she gave me a message of hope. She told me that she had been sober 2 years and that she had done this deal and that she decided to take her will and her life back, and that she decided that she didn't need to go to meetings, and that Alcoholics Anonymous was a little inconvenient, and as a result of being a little inconvenient, she was sitting in a prison cell. So thank you to that woman who carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me, and she never knew she did. And I became a little more willing, and I got into that treatment center of July of 06, and I never ever ever had to take a drink again. I have one desire, Chip, and I'm going to tell you guys that relapse is not, it does not have to be a part of your story. It does not. If you are new, if you are sitting here, if you are not new, if you are thinking about drinking does not have to be an option. That is what you guys told me, that I did not have to drink no matter what. Yeah, but I'm facing 20 to life in prison. You don't have to drink no matter what. Yeah, but what if somebody dies? What if my mom dies? What if my dad dies? You don't have to drink no matter what. Yeah, but what if you don't have to drink no matter what? Go to meetings. Ask for help. Don't drink. I'm like, it's got to be more complicated than that. And there's been a lot of yeah buts. I didn't have to drink no matter what. And so I go into this treatment center, and this treatment center has this little druggy buggy that brings me here. And Sunday morning meeting, the Friday night meeting, and I hear people and I see people talking from this podium, and that's why it's really extra special being here today. I sat back there and I watched people up here, and I watched people over and over and over and over deliver the same message, the same message, the same message, right? Get a sponsor, work the steps, get connected to a higher power and carry this message. Trust God, clean house, help others. Trust God, clean house, help others. I heard it over and over and over and over again, and I started to believe that what they were saying was true. And so I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps, and I got connected to a God I did not believe in, a God that I didn't think could help me. I got connected to this power greater than myself, and I had a sponsor early on that it didn't matter that I had 90 days sober. You have something to offer someone else. My sponsor was dragging me to H&Is. If you don't know what H&Is are, it's hospitals and institutions. My other sponsor used to say, spend a lot of time in places you don't want to end up. So I spent a lot of time in jails, in hospitals, and institutions, carrying a message that I didn't even think I could transmit. But you guys told me that if I was properly armed with some facts about myself, that I could win an alcoholic like nobody else could. And so I did it, and I kept doing it when I didn't want to do it. And you guys also told me that when Alcoholics Anonymous was the most inconvenient is when I needed to show up. One of my absolute favorite parts in the book, and there's a guy here from my home group. He's sitting in the second row. His name is Steve. He's right there. He's probably heard me talk about this a lot, so sorry, Steve, you get to hear it again. And one of my absolute favorite lines in the book is in Bill's story. And he says, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And I had a lot of low spots ahead when I came in here. I like to say it was like that little Zoloft commercial with the little cloud. I had this like 20 to life, 20 to life, 20 to life, 20 to life, 20 to life hanging over me. I got sober in the early bird meeting. I'd come here every morning at 7 a.m., almost every morning. And I look around this room, and there's people who saw me when I was just broken.
right? I was just out of treatment, and I didn't know which way was up, and I didn't know how I was going to get through a day. And I thought these people had substantial amounts of sobriety, and they had like 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years, and there were a few that had double digits, and I just could not fathom what double-digit sobriety looked like. And they were always happy. They're always laughing at 7 a.m., you know, just super cheerful. And I'd walk in, and they were like, "Hey, Lisa, how's it going?" And inside, I'm like, "I'm facing 20 to life. How do you think it's going?" But I would smile and nod and cuss them out internally. And, you know, they would tell me that everything was going to be okay. And I was like, "You don't get it." You know, I thought it was unique when I came in here. You just don't get it. None of you guys have problems like I do. And then I'd sit in a meeting and somebody would share about facing 20 to life in prison and how they were free. And I was like, what? And then somebody else would share about it. And then somebody else. And then somebody would be at the podium talking about how they went to prison and did. And I'm like, God, Lord. All right, I guess I'll stick around. And so I stayed here. And while all this is going on, my attorney keeps postponing my court date. I don't understand why he's doing this. And I just want to get it over with. And, you know, continuance. A year goes by, and I mean, I didn't think I'd be sober a year. I didn't think I'd be sober. I thought I'd get out of treatment, and, well, side story here. I did get out of treatment and try to relapse that day. I got out of treatment, and I went to a meeting so that I would look good, so that everybody at treatment would see me go to a meeting. And I left that meeting, and I went over to a guy's apartment who I used to party with, and he wouldn't let me in. It gets better. And he said to me, "Lisa, I would rather you hate me because I didn't let you in here than you hate me because I did." And then he said, "Get your ass to a meeting." Wow, that's the second time I've cussed from the podium. I never do this. Sorry, guys. And he told me to get to a meeting. And I came here. And it was back when the other smoking room was back there. And I sat back there. It was a Friday. I got out of treatment on a Friday. And I cried and cried and cried and cried and cried in that back room. And there was a woman there, and I don't know where she is today. I mean, she's not sober. I've never seen her. And she sat with me for probably 3 hours, maybe. I sat back there, and I probably told the same story over and over for 3 hours. And I knew that my treatment center was going to be bringing the girls here for the Friday night meeting. And so I had to pull myself together because I didn't want them to see that I had just left treatment at 9 o'clock that morning and I was sobbing my eyes out, you know, at whatever. What time is the speaker meeting on Friday? Is it 8? 8 o'clock? Whatever. Yeah, so I knew they were going to be here about like 7:45. And I came out of there and it was like 7:40 and eyes are all puffy. And I come around the corner and all the girls are there and they're like, "Hey!" And I was just like, oh my God, if these women knew that I just went and tried to screw all of this up. And so when I hear people speak from this podium and say, this place saved their lives, this place saved my life, Club 12 saved my life, like, I didn't understand it. And I didn't really understand how special Club 12 was until I moved away. I've been in Austin for a year and a half, and Austin has some awesome recovery. But what we have here at Club 12 is super special. It's amazing, right? And it's just amazing. And so, you know, my side story that just took like 20 minutes. The whole point of that is that I learned very quickly that this was a safe place I could come. That I could just sit here and cry for hours if I needed to. And you guys, it wasn't an inconvenience to you guys. You guys were just going to love me through it all. And so I'm in this 7 a.m. and I'm sharing every day about how my life is horrible and I'm going to go to prison. And you know, you guys are just smiling and loving me through it all. And about 2 years sober came the day that I had to go face that judge. Well, I had asked a few of you guys to write character reference letters for me. And I was absolutely floored when I went to that judge with 70 character reference letters, mainly from you guys in the early bird. So I go to court that day, and my attorney says, "You are going to prison, right? My only job today is to get you the least amount of prison time." And I mean, I was in full acceptance. I'm 2 years sober. I'd done the work. I'm carrying the message. I'm sponsoring women.
I mean, I am doing this deal. I am prepared to accept my consequence. And I walk into that courtroom, and it is standing room only. It is all of you guys that are in that courtroom willing to break your anonymity and tell the judge that I don't belong in prison. It was like walking into an AA meeting on July 30th of 2008. And I don't know how to repay you guys for that. So thank you. Thank you to people in this room right now who were in that courtroom. To people in this room right now who wrote a letter that said I didn't belong in prison. Because the person that walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous belonged in prison. The woman who walked in will always drink again. I cannot be that woman. So I get into that courtroom and they call a recess. And this prosecutor that wanted to put me away for life had a change of heart. My offense was not punishable by probation. It's a felony offense that probation is never an option. And I get into that courtroom and I get a 5-year probation. It's another miracle of this deal, right? And that 5-year probation had this little stipulation of I could not get released early from probation. And so 20 months into probation, my probation officer calls me and says, as of 3 p.m. yesterday afternoon, your probation's been terminated.
Oh.
What? Thought I couldn't get off early. Yeah, well, you thought you were supposed to go to prison for life, too. So, one miracle after another, after another, after another, after another, after another, right? And I always believed that when my legal stuff was over, I would drink again. I had that in the back of my head. Once I'm not on paper, once I don't have, you know, somebody breathing down my neck, I'm gonna drink again. And the miracle of that is that wasn't an option that day. And it wasn't an option when I got off of probation. Like that just, it never even came into mind. You know, I was 3 years sober and I was doing this deal. And I'll tell you though, what happened for me, which, you know, I look around the room and I've heard some of you share your experience with me and tap into a few of you is that we get some time under our belt and Alcoholics Anonymous isn't so important anymore. And I don't have the judge breathing down my neck and I don't have treatment center and I don't have outpatient and all of a sudden I'm someone and I'm traveling the world and I'm running marathons in different countries and I have a really high paying job and I have like a lot of friends and I joke but I have a debit card in my purse that's connected to my own bank account and my own driver's license and you know maybe I'm not gonna go to a meeting Monday night and yeah I'll make the meeting Tuesday and I know my home group is at noon but I'm kind of busy. And I know I told that sponsee, I don't really want to pick up any more sponsees because I'm kind of busy and I'm kind of traveling this weekend and this is super inconvenient. And at 5 years sober, I had just slammed myself into the ground again. And that emotional bottom, being sober and just not being able to find that connection to God, for me was the absolute worst. It was worse than drinking and using. Because I'm surrounded by all of you guys who have had this spiritual experience and who are continuing to enhance and enrich your spiritual condition. And I'm sitting in the middle of you guys and I can't find it. I don't wanna say I can't, I'm not willing, right? I've lost my willingness. Life has gotten in the way. And you guys told me over and over, don't let the gifts of sobriety take you away from sobriety. And at the time, I didn't think I was close to drinking. At the time, I thought everything was great. You know, I was just in a funk. I kept telling myself, it was just this ick. I just feel icky. I don't want to play Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. I don't have time for Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. Like, I'm 5 years sober. It's not that bad. Yeah. If by the grace of God, I didn't pick up a drink. By the grace of God, I didn't pick up a gun and blow my brains out. Because once that stuff starts and you have no way to shut it up, everything seems like an option. Everything that you swore was not an option becomes an option. And I don't normally name drop from the podium, but I'm going to tell you that God put Stacy Speedlin in my life at 5 years sober, and I know there's a lot of you that know and respect that woman, and I had to do some serious work at 5 years sober. I had to do some intense work that I didn't even know I was capable of doing, and we worked these steps again, and then we got into the good stuff. And if you haven't worked the traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, I encourage you to work the traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you get into this stuff, and this teaches me how to get along with other people. And I don't know how to get along with other people. That 12 and 12 tells me that I do not know how to have a true partnership with another human being. But I get in this, and I start to maybe understand how to get along with another person. And so I work these traditions, and all of a sudden, my relationships at work change. My relationships with my family change. My relationship with you guys changes. But you guys haven't done anything different, right? You guys are still showing up smiling, telling me everything's awesome. And I'm just starting to get a little deeper and starting to understand that in this deal, even though I was 5 years sober, I was living in self. I was sponsoring women, I was taking meetings to places, but it was all about Lisa. How is Lisa gonna look in this? What are you gonna think of me? What's everybody else gonna think of me? I want a pat on the back. I wanna look like I'm the poster child for Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet I'm dying inside. You know, when we sit in meetings and we make these statements like, you know, blah, blah, blah for the newcomer, and blah, 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 the newcomer's the most important person in the room, and the newcomer, look, newcomers, you guys are awesome, but I'm going to disagree, you're not the most important person in the meeting. The most important person in this room is a person who is suffering at that moment, and you don't have to be 2 days sober to be suffering. I can carry the message to somebody that is 2 days sober, 2 years sober, 2 decades sober. There is somebody sitting in this room today who has some time under their belt, who can't figure out why they feel like crap. It happens to us. It was my experience. It's been the experience of a lot of women that I've sponsored and women who have sponsored me. And what I've learned from that is that I can't stop doing what I did when I got here. When I got here, it was really simple, right? Trust God, clean house, help others. Trust God, clean house, help others. And that's what it still is for me today. Trust God, clean house, help others. My life is really full, guys, really full. I've run 19 marathons since 2009. I've run in Italy, I've run in Ireland, I've run in Berlin, I've run in Canada. Like, I'm busy. I work. I have a suit, like, here's the weird thing. I'm in a committed relationship. Like, me. I mean, I'm the person that, no. Like, nobody's going to tie me down. No. And that's a gift of this program is that I can show up and I can have a true partnership with another human being. Total gift of this deal. But I'm going to tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous can be a little inconvenient at times. And I still show up. I have a home group, and I have a service position in that home group. And I told you that home group has about 100 to 120 people a day, and I'm the treasurer of that home group, which means there's a lot of money that I have to count. And it's not fun counting a lot of money. And I would much rather be doing other things than counting a lot of money. But I count a lot of money because it's those things that keep me sober. It's those things that Bill was talking about on the bottom of page 14 and the top of page 15, that I have commitments in place. Because life is going to happen at some point. It's going to happen to all of us. People are going to die. Somebody is going to have an illness. You're going to have to put your kid in treatment. You know, there's going to be affairs. Sponsees are going to die.
You know, that's one I wasn't prepared for. My sponsee died. I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous about to chair the noon meeting when somebody walks up to me, it's 11:58, and they're like, hey, did you hear your sponsee died? And I'm like, and I watch the clock and it hits noon. I'm like, my name's Lisa, I'm an alcoholic. And I start chairing the meeting. Like, there's no other place that I would rather be than in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when I get the news that my sponsee could not stop sticking a needle in her arm. This is life or death for me at 9.5 years sober, just like it's life or death for me when I came in. I don't take this thing lightly. Right? I've sat in this audience and I've heard people up here talk about people they love who went out for 5, 10, 15, 20 days and were dead. And this thing is no joke, right? And I think that we get some time, and I don't know, I can only speak for me, is that I get some time under my belt. And I don't realize how important this gig is. I don't remember what it used to be like because I can only see what it's like right now. And that's why I work with a ton of new women. I love working with newcomers because for me, I can't see God in a book and I can't see God in a building, but I can see God in your eyeballs. And when I'm sitting across the table from an alcoholic, and that alcoholic doesn't have to be a newcomer. When I'm sitting across the table from an alcoholic, I can see God real clearly. You know, I had a sponsor that was really big on gratitude lists. And, you know, some of us sitting here rolling our eyes, right? Another gratitude list. Some of my early sponsors were Nazis, and I'm so grateful that I was not given a deluded message of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had a sponsor that was like, gratitude list, gratitude list, gratitude list, gratitude list, right? And I wasn't allowed to say, like, I'm grateful for my mom and my dad and my car and blah, blah, blah. I wasn't allowed to say any of that. My gratitude list had to be about other people. So I would call her, and I'd have to say stuff like, I'm grateful that so-and-so in treatment was able to see her daughter today for the first time. And I'm grateful that so-and-so, you know, I don't know, got a pass for the weekend. I mean, you know, whatever, right? When you're in treatment, life's pretty small. So there's not a ton of options, right? But she forced me to get outside of myself, right? It wasn't what I was grateful for in my life, but it was what I was grateful for in other people's lives. And it taught me to really see God working in your lives. And once I could see God working in your lives, I was a lot clearer that God was working in my life because I couldn't see it, right? You guys kept telling me. I mean, as I kept coming to this meeting over and over and over, you guys were telling me that something was shifting. You guys were telling me that there was this light in my eyes. You guys were telling me that I was smiling, that I was glowing. And I couldn't see any of that, but you guys could. And so I stand here now and I watch people come into the rooms and pick up their 30-day chip and pick up their 60-day chip and pick up their year. And I'm like, yeah, God's working in your life and you can't see it, but I can see it. I can see it really clearly. And that's the good stuff, right? Like, that's the stuff that you guys told me this deal was about. See, I thought when I got here that it was about not going to prison, getting a car, having some money in my bank account, having a key to my mom's house. Like, I thought that meant I had arrived. But you guys kept telling me I would sell myself short. You told me that my life would look unbelievably different if I just kept doing the work. And I didn't know what that meant. But today I'm real clear on what that means. Right, when I can shut up long enough and listen to you, that's the good stuff. When I can sit at my kitchen table and go through the book, because the way I sponsor is the way that I was sponsored, and I go through this book line by line, page by page with my girls. And I sit across that table and somebody sitting across that table says, what does that mean? And we look it up in the Big Book Dictionary and I see that little light go on in her eyes. That's the good stuff. It doesn't matter how much money is in my bank account.
It doesn't matter that I'm flying to South Africa in a couple of months. Like, that doesn't matter. Those are just some extra cool things I get to do. What matters is that I get to carry a message of hope to an alcoholic who is hopeless, who is just as hopeless as these two were. Right? Like, thank God for these two. I was thinking about Dr. Bob's farewell speech this morning, and so I have my phone up here. And I'm sure most of you have heard this, but you know, the end of his farewell speech, he says, and one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to do numerous little kind and thoughtful acts in our behalf. So let us never get such a degree of smug complacency that we're not willing to extend or attempt to extend to our less fortunate brothers that help which has been so beneficial to us. When I say that I'm as grateful as I know how to be, I don't know how to ever repay you guys. I don't know how I can ever repay anybody who had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, had a connection with a higher power, and gave me a message, transmitted something that they had so that I could have a better life. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you very much. Ooh.